Welcome, everyone, to the Feeling Lighter podcast by WeShape, where we shed old beliefs that no longer serve us one episode at a time. The bottom line is how you feel about yourself changes everything. So I'm Lisa. Are you excited about today?
So very excited.
Yeah.
So very excited.
We did some, you know, we do some prep before these, and this was one of the guests that I was, you know, really eager to connect with. So
same.
I would love for you, if you feel ready, to read her bio, and then we'll make an introduction. We've got some questions already ready to go.
Yes, we do.
Wonderful.
All right. We are talking to Patrilli Hernandez today. Patrilli Hernandez has nearly 15 years of professional experience that has shaped their understanding of health and nutrition, not only as individual pursuits, but how it all seamlessly intersects with our built environment, equity, and social justice. After initially working in the restaurant industry in both back and front of the house for over 5 years, they redirected their love for food to nutrition education, anti-hunger advocacy, and policymaking around food access and food justice. Since then, Patrilli's interest in nutrition has broadened to working to address the other social determinants of health that influence individual and community well-being. Patrilli combines their academic background in culinary arts, anthropology, nonprofit management, and nutrition, and works as a consultant partnering with medical, healthcare, and education providers in integrating weight-inclusive, interdisciplinary, and multidimensional strategies that aim to improve the health of historically marginalized populations. There's so much goodness in that. And
no, that was a good one.
It was so easy to come up with great questions, so I'm really excited for this conversation.
Well, welcome, Patrilli. We're really happy to have you here.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be here as well. I appreciate the invite and the opportunity to share space with you both today.
Wonderful.
Awesome. Thank you.
Do we want to just dive in? I like have my highlighter. We've got some things. Patrilli, I'm going to dive. Well, actually, I would like to actually know how you got into this work. I think this is, I love hearing people's stories and like the context of that. So maybe spend a minute or two just like how did you get to doing the work that you're doing today?
Sure thing. So as the work as it stands today was both a culmination of my personal lived experiences, as well as the things that I'm passionate about and things I hold expertise in. As it was mentioned, I have 15 years of experience in the nutrition kind of public health sector. But I really didn't pivot in the way that I approached my work. And the framework and the lens of liberation in which I apply the work that I do, it wasn't until 2017 where I was diagnosed with an eating disorder. So it was very easy to hide in the nutrition and public health sector as someone with an eating disorder. I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit about why that is. And so having that was really a turning point in my life, in which I really began to further question the root of my beliefs, just in general about food and bodies and health. Specifically the bodies of Black, Brown, Indigenous people of color, and how it's kind of impacted by this narrative, right? This pursuit of thinness, this pursuit of health, and, you know, does it ultimately make us healthy? Mm. And so the past six going on 6 years, that has really influenced the work that I do. And it's been a difficult, uncomfortable, but worthwhile journey.
Wow. I mean, I think that's going to go right into our first question. How do you see the intersectionality of race and class with diet culture playing out and negatively impacting those who are already so marginalized?
Yeah, that was an excellent, that's an excellent question. And I always like to start with, because I am an anthropologist by training, by my formal education, is that, you know, for me, defining what diet culture is, mm-hmm. and the way that I see diet culture, it's like a set of systems and beliefs that basically equates the health of a person with their body size mm-hmm. and their body shape, mm-hmm. right? And it's kind of this unrelenting pursuit of health, which yeah. it equates to in our society today as being someone in a thin body. Mm-hmm. And so this intersects, I think, a lot with class and ultimately race for several different reasons. And I think the first one is that historically, when you look at this notion of health and who's afforded to be most healthy and who we perceive as the ideal healthy person, it usually translates to people that have the most structural and systemic power. Yes. In a society. So, you know, when we look at today, right, the groups of people, the types of social identities that are in closer proximity to this notion of power, which I define as influence or control over labor, over history, over resources. Those are people that reflect certain social identities, certain demographics, right? So those that are thin, whether naturally thin or not, those that are white of European descent, those that have kind of a have that generational wealth passed down, right? Those are most likely to be kind of viewed when you picture somebody that is healthy, or you Google a healthy person, right? Those are the identities that come up. And of course it intersects with race, because when you look at generational wealth, when you look at control over resources, people that don't have that are more likely to be racialized as something other than white. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to be people who are disabled, right? Mm-hmm. They are more likely to be people that are not cisgender. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about this kind of pursuit of health and who this ideal picture of health is, more likely than not, we do picture someone with these kind of systemically dominant identities, mm-hmm. the thinness, the whiteness, the European features, someone that's able-bodied, someone that is cisgender and heteronormative. So this all impacts diet culture, because mm-hmm. we're trying to reach this pursuit of an ideal that for one reason or another is unattainable for the majority of us.
Yes.
Right? Because the people in this country that actually do fit that ideal is actually the minority, right? But yet that is the standard to which we set health.
That's the goal.
And therefore thinness. And that's what we're all working towards. And we spend a lot of time and energy in this impossible feat that most of us will never reach.
Whew, that's so good. I feel like that question, that was an excellent answer. And we could probably talk another hour on it just alone. But when you talk about, you know, and I love your definition of diet culture. When we talk about diet culture in this sense of like pursuit of health, even if we don't understand that for most, you know, people's reasons, it's really about the pursuit of thinness, and not everybody is ready mm-hmm. to like unpack that, right? But if we are just talking about the pursuit of health, can you talk about like what are some of the determinants of health that like diet culture won't even touch? Because I think the general theme of diet culture is like you're responsible for the actions and the behaviors and all of the physical outcomes that you know, that happen to you as a result of what you do and what you don't do. And we've all got the same 24 hours in a day and no excuses and all these things. But what are I'd love for you to talk about those determinants of health that have nothing, you know, aren't exactly in our control that diet culture doesn't necessarily talk about.
Yeah, and I think this is where my public health perspective. So just about Embody Lib, right, why I'm so passionate of applying an interdisciplinary lens to the work is because there are so many different fields, different disciplines that are able to contribute really thoroughly to help kind of unpack what it means for us to be healthy and to pursue health and what it means to remove those barriers, right? And so in public health, we understand that there are a large number of factors that determine a person's health status, mm-hmm. right? Their current state of disease, whether or not they'll develop a disease or chronic illness in the future, how long they will live, their quality of life, right? all of these things that kind of make up a person's health status are determined by a large number of factors. So let's say we had a pie chart. We had a pie chart where it all adds up to 100 of all these different factors. Let's say that there are translated into percentages that determine how healthy a person is, right? So it all adds up to 100. So let's see, you have the diet, right? Mm-hmm. You have your exercise behaviors, you have your sleep patterns, right? Those are all health behaviors. Mm-hmm. So in that pie chart, what percentage of our health is determined by our health behaviors? Why don't you take a guess?
I know it's not a lot. I think it's probably like 15 or less.
I was going to say 10%.
Yeah.
So when we look at the entirety of our health behaviors, right, people don't think that taking your medication is a health behavior.
Oh,
getting your
so
blood
important.
Pressure checked is a health behavior. Your sleep hygiene is a health behavior. Stress management to the little that you can control it mm-hmm. is a health behavior. So on average, the health behaviors, meaning the different decisions that you make, account for anywhere between 25 to 30%,
okay.
right? Within those health behaviors, though, diet and exercise is within this huge chunk of the 30%, where if you were able to break it down even more, what you're actually eating determines maybe anywhere from 5 to 7%.
Wow.
So I got this total health pie.
That's hilarious.
I got to pause for a second, Petrilli, and here's why.
Yeah.
I want to summarize and I want to reflect back to you, I think, a very, very important thing that you just said, and I want to see if I'm on the right path here.
Yes.
What you just said is that there are health-related behaviors that all of us have hopefully the privilege and autonomy to take.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, that counts for about 25 to 30% of our quote-unquote health outcomes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And diet and exercise are a small fraction of that, of those behaviors.
A very small fraction
of many, many, many dozens yeah. of behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
What diet and exercise culture tell us is that diet and exercise are 100.
100.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is,
absolutely.
If nobody walks away with anything today, I want us to walk away with that. And here's why. Not only for our own emotional well-being to mm-hmm. stop criticizing the shit out of
ourselves, yeah.
but so that we stop doing that to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is so critical. I just cannot. Am I on the right path? Did I get what you were saying?
100%. And I think the reason of what you're saying is so important, and we have to begin to ask the question, why is there a belief that says that our health will improve or get worse only based on our diet and exercise, right? Like that is the determining factor. Mm-hmm. The reason that I believe that this is such a common narrative is because the people, again, that are kind of making, that are, how do I say this? The folks that are in charge making the decisions around what it means to be healthy, mm-hmm. they are positioned in a way in a society where all these other social determinants, so that other 70% is in their favor, right? There are no inequities that
wow.
they experience. So for them, eating a certain way, exercising a certain way can make a difference.
Wow.
Because the cards are not stacked up against them.
That's the perspective.
We got to unpack that a little further, I think. We got to unpack. Could you say more to that? Can you say
yes.
more to that? Because that is, because here's what's going to happen. People
Before.
Are going to come in and give evidence as to why, like, the diet and the exercise are the most important thing. So, like, I want to unpack that further, if you don't mind speaking more
Absolutely.
To that.
Absolutely. So this is where we go back to what are the determinants of health. So let's look at that other 70%, right? So the 70% can be broken down to factors that we have much less control over. So for example, a huge part of this pie over 40% is defined as socioeconomic factors,
wow.
right? So it is where you are born. It is where you have lived. It is where you work, you play, you worship, etc. Your zip code in the United States can tell me more about what your health looks like now and what it will look like, rather than more than giving me a 7-day summary of what you've eaten and how much you exercise.
Wow.
You're dropping some good stuff today.
Oh my God.
This is important information.
Yeah.
This is critical.
And so when we look at, right, we talk about power. We talk about who holds power. Who holds power in these spaces that is telling you that diet and exercise will make or break your health, right? Mm-hmm. We have to examine the conditions in which they live, work, and play in that don't have adverse effects, right? So we have to look at this a little bit more closely. I am not here to say that diet and exercise do not have any impact, because they do.
Right.
But you cannot diet and exercise your way out of poverty.
That part.
You cannot diet and exercise your way of not having access to clean water, indoor plumbing, reliable electricity, access to health care that you don't have to drive a couple of hours. You cannot diet and exercise your way out of these things. These are called social and structural determinants of health. And thankfully, there are people, a fair number of people in this country, where their social determinants of health set them up for success. But we also have to consider that for many of us in this country, deeply, deeply, unfortunately, and it's stratified by race, class, and gender, don't have the same, they don't have the same benefits mm-hmm. in their social determinants that, and in turn, that adversely it impacts their health, where dieting and exercising your way, you unfortunately will not be able to do it.
Can I do a little more reflective listening here?
Okay. Yes.
So what I hear you saying is that the people who are owning the narrative around diet and exercise determine your health are the people who have very many needs already met. And so they're
Correct.
Honing in on this sort of like cherry on top, right. but they're forgetting that the ice cream isn't even at the bottom of the sundae. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I like that.
I love that analogy. Very, very right. Because yeah. they already have the foundation. Right.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of us, especially where health inequities in this country are heavily determined by your socioeconomic status and your racial ethnic group, that don't have quite that same foundation. And mm-hmm. those are outside of their control. And it is systemically and structurally embedded. And so what public health aims to do, outside of kind of bringing awareness to those different behaviors, right, that might impact health, but also calls on us to further examine and see what we can do to address those structural and systemic barriers that I spoke
of. It's like a distraction. It's yeah. like, well, they're just not eating healthy, and so this is the problem, so let's give them dietary guidelines. It's like, actually, why don't you provide them with people with clean drinking water?
Yeah.
Or why don't you address educational resources? Or why mm-hmm. don't you address health care or accessibility to a doctor? Like, it's like we're missing huge pillars, and we're honing in. Mm-hmm. And I want to take back my cherry, because it feels like it's actually just one of the sprinkles on the whipped cream. It's not even large enough to be the cherry.
It's like 5%. So yeah, definitely.
So it seems like we're just needing to pause and like mm-hmm. step outside of our own experience and maybe get curious if other people are having that same lived experience, and how we are maybe deeply overinflating the value of this small sprinkle on this sundae mm-hmm. and how we're missing a much bigger problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think part of it is that it feels very overwhelming, mm-hmm. right?
It does.
It feels incredibly overwhelming, especially in this day and age where we feel like there are so many people are struggling in ways that we feel like is completely out of our control, and there's nothing we can do. right? Yeah. I am of the mindset, right? I am an advocate, and I believe in the power of communities, of individuals, to be able to empower themselves and the people around them, to bring around change, right, on a grassroots level. I think when we look at it really broadly and say, oh, well, you know, like, we just can't solve hunger in this country, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we just can't solve the housing crisis, right? Like, we can't, making sure that everybody makes a thriving wage, like, that's just, like, beyond us. But I think things are set up in a way to intentionally make it feel very overwhelming and out of our hands, where part of the work I do, which I believe is a huge part of public health, is building a community, empowering each other and empowering ourselves to see how we can use advocacy, use, you know, things like voting, things like community organizing as a way to make our communities better, that in turn do make them healthier.
Yeah. Oof. This is so good. So some of the discussion around these social determinants of health, which I just don't think there is enough discussion about it. But I think, and you spoke to this idea that the people in power, you know, all of those basic needs are met, so it's fine. But when we talk to people who don't have access to certain things, I still think, like Katie was saying, there's just so much shame, like, given to them. Like, you're not making the right choices. You're not eating the right things, specifically when we talk about food. And I know this is our segue into processed foods, because it's like a big thing. Every time I'm on social media, there's someone saying, don't eat this. You shouldn't eat that. This is going to kill you. This is horrible for your body. You know, what are you doing to yourself? And you're like, okay, I was just grabbing some chips because I was in between meetings, or I had to go to Chick-fil-A or some fast food restaurant because we were on our way to a kid event. You know, like, there's convenience in processed foods, and but also so much shame. And I would love to hear your perspective in speaking to this idea that, you know, processed foods are shameful and something that we, if we cared about ourselves, we wouldn't ever eat or ever have, you know?
Right, right. So, you know, I do want to preface this response with, I come from a family of people that really value science. My father was a biochemist for many years. My brother is a dietitian and studied food science. I come from a line of, especially on my father's side of the family, scientists. So I do really value science and what nutrition science has to say. Mm-hmm. We cannot deny that what is classified as ultra processed foods are having a metabolic and physiological impact on our bodies, right? There is a lot of really well-grounded science that is showing that. The issue is, and this is what I struggle with, because I'm also a social scientist. So when you deal with people that are in more of the biological sciences, like, it's banging my head against the wall where science cannot occur in a vacuum, right? Yeah. You cannot apply science devoid of the cultural context, right? So despite us knowing that this is what the science says, right? This is what studies are demonstrating. We cannot separate that from the environmental context in which we move through the world. Mm-hmm. So the fact is that ultra processed foods, they came to the forefront because there was a perceived need. What was that need? Specifically in the context of the United States, in like in the Americas, we needed to get foods. We needed to find a way to be able to eat food in a way that is convenient, that is easily accessible, that is easily affordable, right? Mm-hmm. Because that is reflective of the way we were living our lives and the way that we do live our lives, right? And that has not slowed down at all.
No.
And so in fact, the rate or the speed in which we lived our lives has only has only gotten faster, right?
Yep.
So processed foods and ultra processed foods, whether or not, you know, science views them as having a negative impact on our bodies, I think that's the wrong question, right? I think that we need to start with, okay, what are people calling for? Are they calling for making foods more from scratch, right? Mm-hmm. Eating foods that are in the less processed forms. Okay, great. But did you realize that we don't have time to do that, mm-hmm. right? Like, I deal a lot with single parent families.
Yeah.
Okay. Single parent families that have to make the nightly choice. Am I going to help my child with their homework for the day and take them to soccer practice? Or am I going to take 90 minutes out of my day to prepare a home cooked meal? Mm-hmm. For the majority of working families in this country, that is the choice they need to make daily.
Yeah.
And I feel like these processed foods, ultra processed foods, they are able to meet that need, and they're able to meet that need effectively.
Yeah.
Right. So again, we have to look at the society in which we're living in. What are our values, right? What are these other determinants that that determine, I don't want to repeat the word. Mm-hmm. What are the other factors that determine how to survive in this world,
right?
And that means making these choices.
Yeah.
And this kind of shame behind ultra-processed foods, processed foods, to kind of bring it back, I think, again, right, there is a, I don't want to say that there's a lack of understanding, but there is their empathy, and their empathy is not being directed in the place where it needs to be.
Right.
Right. There are, just like I said, there are a lot of different things that contribute to a person's health status. And that's not just physical health, right? That's mental health.
Yeah.
That's social emotional health, right? And especially when we're dealing, because this conversation seems to come up the most around parents,
mm-hmm.
right? Parents who are doing their best trying to just feed their children.
Yeah.
When there are so many other competing things that we also need to ensure to make sure that our children are healthy, not only physically, but also mentally and social emotionally, which I can argue in this day and age, that is a bigger crisis, I think, than the physical health of our children.
I agree.
The mental and social emotional health of our children right now should be something we should 100% be focusing on. And so I feel like this conversation in itself around processed foods and shame could also turn into something a lot bigger, because I think it really touches on also, right, like if the request is to ban ultra-processed foods or to limit them, right, are we willing to have the conversation around why these foods are necessary in the first place and the demanding lifestyle of Americans, right? the fact that a lot of us are overworked, we're exploited,
mm-hmm.
we're stressed out, we're tired, right? If we ban ultra-processed foods, are we ready to remedy all of those things? Ooh. I don't think so, because at the end of the day, the fact that we're overworked, stressed, exploited benefits the bottom line of a lot of people. And absolutely. They don't want to make that compromise.
I think I have this visual in my mind, and I actually almost feel silly for my questions, because it's like the like I have this visual of like a limb being ripped off and then like a scab being on the arm, and we're like, let's address that scab of processed foods, and you're like, but the arm just got ripped off, like why are we addressing that scab? And I also feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if we only hone in on policy around processed foods and those become removed, we're not actually solving the hunger problem. We're probably actually going to make that worse, actually.
For sure.
Yeah.
So our focus is just in the wrong spot, it sounds like.
And I think, right, this kind of current discourse around ultra-processed foods and how it relates to food insecurity, erases or diminishes the many barriers and issues that come in play when it comes to struggling with food insecurity. It is not just about only having access to a certain kind of food because that's what's available in your neighborhood, right? Like, that is just a very small piece. What people do not realize, and I have to bring attention to, is that when you look at the cost of food and eating, it's not just the monetary cost. Time.
Yeah.
Time is a cost. Mm-hmm. When you're, for example, I'm bringing a household that's struggling with food insecurity that has children, which is the most common form of food insecurity in this country. If your choice is to purchase an already made meal that you can pop in a microwave, that you can pop in one of those toaster ovens and feed your family of four and still have time to sit around the table and talk and share and the food is tasty to them, rather than using those dollars to go to the store, pick up raw ingredients that you don't have the right equipment for because your stove is broken. Mm. You don't have the time to peel all of those because you want to make sure your kid isn't watching TV and is doing something more constructive, right? When we talk about time and the cost of preparing food, serving food, a lot of times that doesn't enter the conversation.
True.
And so ultra processed foods can be life-saving in many ways if your goal is to be able to nourish and nurture your family mentally and social emotionally with the little resources you have, cooking resources, time resources, the knowledge and expertise, right, to be able to make a tasty meal out of raw ingredients. I think those are all areas that I wish we were having more in-depth discussions around rather than just saying, well, we need to get rid of ultra-processed foods. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, great. And then what?
Yeah, because it sounds like even with that, we're going to have more problems because, absolutely. I mean, for all the reasons you just shared. So I feel like I'm taking up all the questions, Lisa.
I'm listening so intently because I just don't think this stuff is talked about enough. And I think going back to this idea of shame, when we talk about the attainment or the pursuit of health, you know, and you pointed out, like, no one's saying it's bad to want to be healthier or to try to make decisions that are going to improve your health status. But if you're not cognizant of the other factors and the determinants that, you know, that mainstream diet culture will never talk about, then you might find yourself kind of running in circles and on this hamster wheel. And back to that idea of what we see as healthy being this one, like, perception of a person, like, mm-hmm. this thin, white, typically male, like, person who, you know, body looks a certain way. We didn't even talk about, you know, the other determinants of like body size being like genetics or health, you know, right? Your genetic makeup. We're striving to be something that, like you said, a lot of us are never going to be. And I think it gets back to that black and white thinking about how health is like you either have it or you don't. You brought up people in differently abled or disabled bodies. Like, health exists on a spectrum, and there's conversation to be had about health improving behaviors, but it doesn't have to come at the expense of people who don't have as much health, if that makes sense. And so I just hear a lot of opportunities for compassion and
absolutely
learning
and shifting the attention. Right. Let's shift the attention. Like, how silly is it now, knowing these facts, this data, that look at how much time we spend there in diet and exercise. I mean, it's silly after this. Yeah. It's silly.
And I think a key part, right, of diet culture that kind of keeps us in this cycle is that it views health as a very individual issue,
right?
Where a lot of the things that I've talked about that are structural, that are social, that if we're able to effectively address those, we can impact the health of many people.
Tons of people, yeah.
And so, you know, thinking about if we thought of health as not only our individual interpersonal, I am healthy, you are healthy, but what it means for a community to be healthy. In a way, let me caveat this, in a way that still supports their autonomy, I think we would get a lot further, because I don't want my words to be construed, because this is what happens, especially in the food justice, in the food equity space, is that for us, we're like, oh yeah, we want communities to be healthy. So what happens is that there are rules, there are arbitrary measures, there are a lot of initiatives that are poured into historically marginalized communities that they didn't ask for, they have no input in, does not reflect their own values and their cultural heritage, thinking that, oh, well, we're helping them be healthy. No, it is about working together.
You're not the hero.
In a way that's like paternalism.
Hero mentality.
And about, right, what it means for a community healthy, for a community to support health, but to still have an autonomous relationship.
Co-collaboration is what I hear you say. It's not just about like, this is what we think it is, and so we're gonna just offer it and look at how incredible. It's like, no, that's not how that works.
Like, it definitely needs to be collaborative. And so, right, like a lot of these things, as I mentioned, right, there are entire communities in this country that are struggling with clean tap water. And then at the same time, there are policies being put in place to increase the price of sugary beverages, right? Like when folks do not trust their water source and it has a history of being unclean water, they're going to look for low cost options to hydrate. And a lot of them end up in sugar sweetened beverages. So it's like we can't demonize those decisions, because the rationale is actually based in historical oppression. Like, they're doing what they need to do to be able to feel safe in a society where historically the very foundation, right, so of the social determinants of health, the foundation has not been provided.
I know we're coming up on time, but I think I just want to say, I just feel like, I hope people listening to this, I think that, you know, in all transparency, I used to run a body transformation company. I've come, you know, I've gone down a different path. And so I know the feeling of becoming aware of new information and how my privilege served me. And that can feel hard to hear. And I want to encourage people to, if you're listening to this and you've held beliefs and judgments around people and processed foods, to just pause, to not go straight into defense, and well, the science says this, and it's like we're missing the message here today.
Yeah,
I think to walk away from this episode and say, my lived experience may not reflect that of someone else,
right?
And I'm curious about that more, and I'm curious about what it looks like for me to hold space for somebody outside of my own experience, I think is what my hope that people can hear from this today. And I think you've done such a phenomenal job of eloquently and gracefully communicating some facts around this. And I deeply appreciate your education today. So thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think this processing of discomfort and the application of this curiosity, right, can help us move through really difficult emotions, because it is hard to hear, right? We are, as I say, we are the experts of our own lived experiences. And if we have lived through something, it is very easy to see it as the only truth, right? And the best way. And the thing is, right, is that what I'm sharing and talking about today doesn't impact just a few people. It impacts the majority of us, right? There are actually not very many people in this world that, 100% benefit from their proximity to power and their resources, right? All of us have intersecting identities. Yeah. We have intersecting lived experiences in which we've experienced marginalization in some way, but also we benefit, right? That is the majority of us. Mm-hmm. I think what you're asking for that I think is so it's so important is to, you know, have that empathy for others as well. Yeah. Like, I have experienced some hard things in my life that has shaped the way that I believe about things, especially around diet and exercise, right? There are other people that have experienced hard things. And you know, where can we build bridges? Like, where can we collaborate to work through issues, right, that are impacting a lot of people. So I really appreciate that kind of call to action for your audience.
And I want to highlight something. People can do this. They can just go Google these terms themselves. But there's a difference between empathy and pity. And I think that it's really important to understand that difference. So spend some time in that as well.
Yeah.
I was working with a mentor one time and I said something and she was like, sounds like you have a lot of pity. And I said, no, I have empathy. Yeah. And she's like, that's not empathy. So let's do a little bit of digging and research on those terms. learn from my mistakes there. But again, Petrilli, we deeply appreciate the work that you do and the educational awareness that you're providing us today. Before we go, we got to ask the feeling lighter big question.
Yeah.
What's an old belief that you have shed that has impacted your life in a big way?
Yeah. So I think, you know, especially prior to being diagnosed with an eating disorder, I was very much on the diet culture train. Mm-hmm. I believed there was bad food and there was good food. There was a right way to do something, especially around your diet, around exercise. And there was the right way and there was the wrong way, right? Breaking free of this kind of binary way of thinking has really been liberating.
Yeah.
Because it allows me to understand that there are multiple truths that can occur at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've learned to embrace nuance, right? For example, I could agree that the science shows that ultra-processed food is altering the way our body functions, while still understanding that banning ultra-processed foods or telling people not to eat them will not improve the health of people in this very moment, right? A lot of things have to be done, right? Like, I can embrace those two things. I can embrace the fact that, you know, people have... they should have autonomy over their body and their body journey, while still also understanding that there has been such an overemphasis on placing value on body size, in regards to our health status, that has a huge influence on the way we think about our body journey, right? Yeah. So, like, holding both of these things, and they are grounded in empathy because they do honor every person's individual experience, but I also like to look at, right, the context, kind of the broader environmental factors, because a lot of time that influences our way of thinking and our belief systems. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that has been probably one of the biggest lessons I've learned over the course of 6 years.
That's a good one. That is a good one. This has been such a great conversation, Petrilli. I'm so glad that you joined us. Can you tell our listeners where to find you, how to connect with you? If there's something you got going on, you know, just let us know.
Absolutely. So I do have a website. It's called EmbodyLib, and the address is www.embodylib.com. There you can learn a little bit more of my framework, the different offerings that I have. You can join my mailing list. I am in the works of actually releasing a body liberated learning portal. Nice. Where you'll get access to digital courses various topics and lots of content that I have developed over the years will be all housed in one place. And I'm most active on Instagram. You can find me. My handle is the Body Lib Advocate. That's the THE_BodyLib, BodyLib Patrilli_advocate. And I believe there you can access my blog and kind of other things I have going on that I post in my stories and on my page.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you again, Patrilli. Such a pleasure to connect with you. And we will see everyone next week.
Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's show. Now, before you go, it would mean a lot to us if you could take a moment right now to subscribe to the podcast and then leave us a review. This helps spread the word so more people can feel lighter by shedding one belief at a time. Also, we want to hear from you. So if this episode impacted you or you have any questions that you think would be great for us or any of our future guests, please feel free to email us at podcast@weshape.com. And finally, if you want to try WeShape's different approach to health and fitness, remember that right now you can sign up for WeShape's Feel Good Challenge and get access to everything WeShape has to offer for free. Just click the link in our podcast description or go to weshape.com/challenge to sign up.